now locked in with New Models.
Welcome to New Models. This week we're releasing two videos of an event we hosted on June 21st at Sybil in Berlin. Part one is a talk that artist Trevor Paglen gave for the launch of his book, How to See Like a Machine. Part two, for subscribers only, is a discussion between Trevor and Matt Dryhurst, moderated by me, Lil Internet, and my New Models co-host, Carly Busta. What you're about to hear is the audio of that discussion. But if you'd like to watch video of the very crowded event, with people sitting on the floor, listening outside the windows, and occasionally blocking the camera with their heads, it's available on Patreon and Substack. Let's get into it.
So officially. So Trevor, thank you. That was really, really great. I wanted to point out the fact that you named this How to See Like a Machine rather than How do Machines See, right? And I asked Claude, of course, what are some other books that have that formula? Like How to X Like Y, How to Write Like Chekhov, How to Invest Like a CEO, How to Think Like a Spy, How to Run Like a Kenyan, How to Make Friends and Influence People. It's like, you know, like thinking like a machine is aspirational in your framing, which is interesting, right? And so I guess the question, just to sort of start a dialogue between the two of you, would be like, what makes machine vision aspirational? And like, obviously you can extrapolate 10,000 examples from your talk why we'd want that, but I want to hear you sort of speak to like why it's aspirational or why we would want it. Like, what does being able to see like a machine unlock for a human? And both of you have spent a lot of time, like the, and also we should note that you're also like studio mates or neighbors, studio neighbors. So
yeah,
you've known each other.
There was a period of time 10 years ago where three or four people working on AI and art were in Kreuzberg.
Yeah.
It was basically us.
On the same block.
On the same block, us and Gene Kogan.
Yeah.
It was like, yeah.
So yeah, like why have you guys been like thinking, like trying to see like machines while also remaining incredibly human? I will also say that Trevor and Matt and Holly are like some of the, and Lacey, who's also here, I should say, are like deeply human people, like really not this kind of like tech overlord type who lives in a simulation. Like Trevor learned to scuba dive so that he could touch the cable. I don't know if he touched the cable, so you could photograph the cables. I mean, like really like material. And you know, so like, yeah, like why, like where, maybe you can both speak to that. Like, what is the value of us wanting to know how to see like machines? Go.
Okay, so the inspiration, the title actually was inspired by a book by Jim Elkins called How to Use Your Eyes, right? So art historian, anyway. So for me, the point of saying how to see like a machine was to kind of get at trying to understand the logic of how computer vision systems work, generative AI systems work. So on one hand, it's kind of an attempt to demystify them, you know? And on the other hand, to kind of show, you know, seeing is never neutral. Like we always have priors that, you know, we have prejudices, bias, what have you. That those are features of perception, really. And it like literally does modulate how you perceive things. If you are somebody who's a fan of Donald Trump, you literally hear something different when he speaks than I do, right? That's really weird, right? So the point of like the idea of how to see like a machine is that like if you can get your, if you can train yourself to understand the logics that different computer visions or AI systems are using to make sense of the world, then you can, on one hand, analyze them more effectively. You can kind of see what are the possibilities and limits within these systems. You can start to understand what sort of political economies are going to be associated with those forms of seeing. But then you can also start to notice like, oh, these are the kinds of tricks that get used in an AI system to make me hallucinate something. I can recognize that that trick is being done. And so I can maybe kick that up from a precognitive part of my sensory stack to the rational part and say like, I mean, I do or do not want to participate in the TikTok video of somebody eating spaghetti or whatever it is, right?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I really enjoyed the talk. I guess that the impulse for me is, you know, we have through deep learning incredible powers. We showed, actually, we did a show together in Venice. We all did a show together in Venice quite recently, and we showed the biologist Michael Levin as an artist And one of the things that Levin talks about, which I find to be really useful and true, is, you know, our understanding of who we are is always limited to the optic systems we have.
Yeah.
So for example, Descartes came up in the interview I was listening to on the way here. And, you know, there was a period of time where our imaging systems allowed us to look at a brain, poke it, right? And then say, oh yeah, we're in there somewhere, right? That there's a certain part of the brain, is the amygdala or something like that, that this is the special part that makes us human.
In Descartes, it's the pineal gland,
the pineal
right?
Gland, the pineal gland. So at that period of time, it wasn't that he was stupid, it's just that we only had that level of insight into who we were, and we tend to over-index for that and say, oh no, well, this is what distinguishes us from the apple,
yeah,
right? What's interesting now is we have remarkable imaging systems that can actually see far deeper than we can. They report back to us. Mm-hmm. And as a truth seeker, I'm very curious what those conclusions might be, which is not to say that there will not be all manner of manipulations in that, yeah, so on and so forth, but the sheer capacity that we have to do that, and this is very commensurate with Bratton's analysis, right? Like, people who complain about climate change will complain about data centers, but it's the data centers that allow us to know that climate change exists in the first place, right? So you have to kind of embrace this new technology that we have in order to try and find out who we are and what we do. And so I think that that's kind of the neutral position on it. Beyond that, I think that, to your point, it just raises really interesting questions of saying, you know, for me, for example, one thing that I think is really interesting when you talk about the breaking of the image, I've been looking a lot at this kind of maybe 300-year hallucination of the autonomy of art.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So when we talk about art, it's like images are over, maybe art is over,
yeah,
as we understand it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the whole concept of autonomy of art, right, is a 300-year hallucination that was very useful. It's very cool, and you might even want to defend it, of saying, no, art is disentangled, right? Art is this thing, you go into a white space, you're not, it doesn't interact with the market or stupid human thing. Everyone knows it's not true, right? But it's only to this point whereby, you know, images or the kind of the logic of that has been kind of accelerated to such an extent that it's now breaking, that you just can't deny it anymore.
Yeah.
To the extent that when you bring up slop, I mean, I don't like the word slop, but you know, people use it. Mm. Looking at slop online is simply just, I look at it and I'm like, this is no different to the last 20 years of media.
Totally, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But maybe the invention of slop and the fact that it is just overwhelming us is making it undeniable for everybody that this was kind of a mode of experiencing media that is no longer tenable, right? That can no longer exist.
I mean,
you had a great definition of slop, which exactly. Is that what you should...
Slop is the media that attention networks prompt humans to make.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Again, that nice reversal of like, what is this?
But that's true, right?
And
you don't have to use a generative, right, you know, a diffusion model.
No, totally. You can use focus groups, or you can look at, you know, film things and people figure out what ending they like the best. And that's,
yeah, exactly.
But like, what is different though is that you do have these real time feedback loops with the media. And that's different than like Nielsen ratings or, you know, survey groups or that kind of thing.
Yeah. Should we restate what you said? All media is training data, but then Trevor, All media
consumption is reinforcement learning with human feedback.
Yep. Right.
And all I would say though is I agree with you, but it has been that way for 20 years.
Right. You know, in a really inefficient way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It just gets more efficient.
I mean, it's kind of like this machine vision. It's been around for a long time, but it's only been in the past, like, let's say really 10 years, maybe 20, where it's hit a certain escape velocity of like being something much different. I mean, it's interesting actually, Matt. So I should also say that right now there was a show in Venice curated by Matt and Holly with Hans Ulrich Obrist and the Palazzo Dieto's Adriana Rispoli called Strange Rules. And it's on what is being called protocol art. And Trevor is in it with a fascinating piece that maybe we'll talk about. We're in it with Joshua Citarello with a piece designed by Julia, who's right here also. Thank you from Sub. But so this, you know, Matt, Trevor tipped me off. Trevor does this amazing piece in the Strange Rules show called Voyager. And there are no physical images in the show. The idea is that you render the images in your brain through hypnosis. You submit to being hypnotized. You get to choose one of, I think, 6 paths, and then you are prompted to render those images in your head. But so it made me look at in the 1950s, there were a lot of artists who were very interested in rules, like John Cage, of course, and then Alan Caprow, and, you know, we think all of Fluxus is downstream of this, Situationist International. I mean, there's so many movements that are really rule-obsessed in the 1950s. It's because at that very moment, like in the 1940s is when 1948, 1949, 1950, Norbert Wiener's Cybernetics is published. Alan Turing's Turing test is published as, I forget, the Imitation Game or something. You have Claude Shannon's information theory. This is circulating, and artists are like, oh, rules. This is interesting. This could be art.
But it's also a reaction to the Second World War and the idea that, like, German, you know, romantic poetry is barbaric. And, you know, so it is like a doubling down on, like, reason and the rational as a part of that whole thing.
That's really interesting. That's right. So how do you think that that moment, and the analogy I was thinking is, like, machine vision's been around for a long time. It's only recently that it's like really become, it's like there's been a scalar jump that's changed things. And my real question is just how is the protocol art that we're doing now different from this post-war period when dealing in information spaces was a little bit more like possible? And like, I mean, Matt, I remember you said until a few years ago, you could make an AI model and compete with whatever Google was doing. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly within the matter of like 6 months, it just like completely departed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that something Trevor said earlier, and I'm really going to butcher the paraphrasing, but you were talking about images ceasing to be representational, but instead being productive. Was that, mm-hmm. was that the right? And I think that's an interesting thing to bring over to the autonomy in art conversation, yeah. right? Because, and this is an interesting context to have at Sybil or at Trust or with new models, where the kind of cooties that one would have of when you talk about like institutional critique, most critically, most importantly, it was happening within the institution,
yeah.
right? It was playing to a home crowd, right? And the big kind of, the big no-no with that people, curious people have been doing is saying, we don't have to do that anymore, right?
Right.
And moving elsewhere. And the other big no-no is saying, well, art is not, you know, in and of, what's it, art for art's sake.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So to say that images move from representation to being productive or reproductive in the case of AI, you're saying, okay, well, you know, what if you were to make art that did real things in the world mm-hmm. that wasn't just pure representation? Because now I'd say the difference from the 50s is that you could actually do that. There are still limitations as to do that, but like maybe the great opportunity always was to deploy something direct to the iPhone in the last 20 years, right? And very few people have done that, and there's been a lot of belly aching about whether that qualifies as art or not, or maybe that doesn't matter. But you can definitely, I think, if you're having an honest conversation, say that as far as culture goes, as far as any pretense, which is one of the great alibis of art, that it has this pretense of having this influence on the world or provoking new ideas or new sensations in people. If you're trying to do that and you're not using the tools of the day or the tools of people who are doing that anyway, you know, you're not really doing what you say you're going to do, right? Mm. And so I think that when it comes to protocols for me, it starts, one, from that simple observation of just being like, the people working on Instagram have more cultural influence than anyone posting to a square on Instagram. Mm-hmm. That's just obvious. And now, as a result of some of the, you know, these generative models, we're going to see an explosion of people who don't speak the language of that, right? That don't speak software, making software. Yeah. And so the opportunity there, in a sense, is to say, okay, well, what kind of, you know, what kind of protocols or infrastructure do you actually want to build?
Yeah, no, what I was taking is the prompt from your version of the protocol art, the thing being very different than like Karlheinz Stockhausen or something like that, is that I think the newer version of it acknowledges the fact that we are so entangled in hybrid, naturalistic, technological, computer vision, like all this stuff, are the boundaries are so blurry where the human is and the nature is and the technology is, that we're just going to take that as the condition and use those entanglements as like a premise.
Right. Yeah, and also what you're saying, I mean, you're coming up with, I haven't fully read the book, but in your proposal talking about activations or machine realism, you're coming up with an aesthetic theory in accordance with that, right? Yeah. I've been looking at, like, does anyone know this guy, Don Ide?
No.
So if you look at like the history of aesthetics, there's all kind of competing, right? So some people, aesthetics is beauty, right? Which I think is pretty dumb.
Yeah.
And then to some, aesthetics is the sublime, right?
Yeah, also dumb, yeah.
Yeah, okay. but know if you are like a person who subscribes to the sublime idea of encountering something that is greater than yourself, that is not of nature but resembles it or something like this. You know, Don Ide has done a lot of work on that with interactions, for example, with devices and, right, you know, and just see, looking at how entangled we are with these technological systems, yeah, and saying there is actually a theory of aesthetics here that hasn't been.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is weirdly where I turn to magic. You know, I think about a lot. You know, we're having a conversation, then you look at your phone and you have an Instagram ad for like whatever the fuck we were talking about. This is like telepathy. This is the occult. I mean, like the lived experience of some of this stuff is very supernatural.
Yep. You know? And it's going to get more so because, again, one of the, so to give you my priors, like number one, because a lot of the examples you raise, there's plenty of reasons to be really worried.
There's plenty of reason to be really worried.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, we'd mentioned in Venice, and it's worth raising for this room, you know, the proposition of like the National Institute of Cognitive Security, right? Of saying like, well, when you can activate images directly in someone's brain, like that seems like a really big fucking deal. But, yeah, like we should. But then the other side to it too is, and where my optimism comes from, is I don't know if it is actually a foregone conclusion, for example, that the dynamics of the attention economy that we all know and love, mm-hmm, are inevitable in this next future, right? Yeah. So for example, one of my priors is in the next 18 months, we're going to start seeing devices come out because the natural state of interacting with an LLM, for example, is not necessarily looking at a screen.
Yeah.
Right. One of the remarkable things about Anthropic and OpenAI making as much money as they do, mm, is that unlike Facebook and Google, who were like, hey, we've got all this engagement, we have all these network effects. Yes. How do we make money from this? Oh, ads. Right. Right?
Yeah.
So even though, I mean, people ought to be cautious about, yeah, any moves to sneak advertising into these interactions. Mm-hmm. The one thing I really like about LLMs, mm-hmm, is it's a private environment where I can just kind of go deep. I pay money for it. I'm like, well, why do you need advertising in that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some of the most profitable companies in history already. We're like, why insert?
Are they though? I thought they were. Oh, yeah. No, I don't. That cloud subscription, you're getting the better end of that deal.
Well, for the time being, I mean, a lot of the compute is subsidized, so on and so forth. But in terms of the interaction of people spending $200, mm-hmm, in order to access a private environment where they can, you know, access this intelligence,
but why push back? That's not a private environment though.
Well, longer conversation.
Longer
conversation. Let's longer.
Exactly.
But a more interesting conversation is, say, does it need to not be a private environment?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, is it a foregone conclusion that it is not? Because the assumption is that with these tools, the ad economy and the attention economy, which was basically the alibi to justify the growth of the internet, yeah, in the past 20 years, there's a strong moral and, I think, kind of feasible economic argument to be made that it need not be that way, that there's other ways to monetize.
There is, but then why does OpenAI do that? That's such a smart idea, Matt. Like, there is a psyop-y element to it.
You know? For sure. No, I mean, for sure. And there's also, like, different degrees of advertising, right? Like, people would say, you know, if you're paying to be the first result,
yeah,
when someone searches for whatever, a bit of an issue, but you know, there's also challenges with the ad economy where, like, people, for example, report that they enjoy. Like, if I go to, I'm looking for a vacuum cleaner and I go to Wirecutter or whatever, yeah, I enjoy having that recommendation made to me because it saves me time or something. Totally. You know? So there's a gradient of utility in these things.
Yeah.
But the bigger, maybe to be more optimistic about this, it's now also would be the time to look at those structures, pull them apart, and say, well, is there a foregone conclusion here? Like, how would one organize a society around these tools, mm-hmm, given the different,
If I can just pull something out here then. So when we think about enlightenment, the beginning of this time when we start talking about art objects, we have vision is power, right? This is, you have a hot air balloon, you suddenly can survey a larger area, you can therefore control it. Or you have a microscope, you can see a smaller particle, you can therefore act with that knowledge in like a prophylactic way. You can protect against something. We now have a kind of vision which isn't about seeing, it's just about information. It's a definition of vision which is more like a visionary or a seer, mm-hmm, and starts to go towards something that's kind of like the occult.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, like, historically always, every oracle, every seer, every occult, tantric, whatever, always had a very special protocol around accessing it and when it was acceptable to access. And when I think about like the political economy of the image, or rather maybe the political economy of vision, I start to think about this. Now you can certainly buy your way to different levels of vision. And of course, to some degree, that's always the case. You know, you can have predictive models. That's not exactly something new. Or I'm sure wealthy would pay oracles to like say certain things, and then they would enact things that would make it come true. But how do we, what do we think about the rituals around this kind of extended vision in this like more occult sense? Mm-hmm. Like what are the, I don't know, guardrails, or let's just say protocols, rituals that you already see? And what do you think maybe should be there so that it's not just a question of like, is this more or less useful? Who can pay for it? But is there sort of some sort of collective spirit level thing that we need to assess when it comes to how, because this vision is incredibly powerful. I mean, Palantir and Anduril, these defense tech companies, they're not defense companies so much as they are vision companies. Like that's what they sell is vision, right? And predictive capacities. So how do you both think about the ritual around access to this new vision?
I mean, so, okay, I have thoughts on the kind of policy side as well as the kind of occult side. I mean, on the policy side, like in the US, we have like the right to not be searched in your house, right? And that's been interpreted as the right to privacy. And that often is interpreted as like, I don't get to see what's in your wallet. The ritual there is I get a warrant, right? So you do go through that thing. But I think that I'm not ready to give up on the privacy thing. I think it's been mostly really misunderstood. I think people conceive of privacy as an individual right, but that's not what it is. It is a collective resource, right? And so that, I think a lot of stuff, like if you actually had like comprehensive like regulation about what kinds of data can be harvested and what kinds of context and what you can use that data for, we would be really living in a very different media environment than what we are now. Now, and some of that I think would be like a good thing, right? So I guess that's just, when you're talking about that ritualistic aspect of it, that does get translated into a policy and political context through things like, you know, judges and warrants and things like that. On the other hand, where I'm inclined to go with this is like looking at new, like emerging forms of aesthetics, right? And so like in a conversation with Gideon, for example, Gideon be like, well, I just think images are not going to work anymore, right? That we'll just get over them. And I'm like, has porn ever gone away? Right?
But it's operational.
Well, it's exactly. It's like the whole point of a lot of this operational stuff is that it's not something that you get over. It's like targeting you on like this neurological level. Like in the same way that like you put a Dorito in your mouth, you're going to be like, oh, that's intense. Or, you know, you drink, you know, Coke, you're like, wow, that's like really fizzy and feels great. You know what I mean? It's like, it's eliciting a behavioral response from you, right? So what is aesthetics in that environment, right? So on one hand, you can have this kind of like psyop aesthetics that you are subject to and that you react to even when you know what it's doing to you. Like when Trump pumps these like bullshit memes of himself, like as the Pope or whatever, I react to that very strongly and very negatively, even though I don't want to take it seriously. So I think that's kind of one direction. And then we were talking about like 6-7 aesthetics again too, which is like the return of Dada, which is just like, what, how do you create meaning when like storytelling, narrative, images like are so kind of deracinated that like you need something extra imagistic, or you need something that's precisely not an image in order to have that work. I mean, that's kind of what the Voyager piece is about too.
Yeah, I think a couple of things come to mind on that. I mean, so for context, I've spent many years looking at data permissions, which is really dry.
Do you also come from a background of like noise music and underground stuff? So you also, yeah, like your occult knowledge is also quite...
Oh, no, yeah, I've definitely, this is not my first like rodeo on the, yeah, I defer to Trevor on that, but yeah, I'm experienced. But on the data permissions, that was actually my main motivation to work on it. Was more, again, I forgot to say this earlier, but my other prior is, you know, in the next 18 months, these devices are going to launch
yeah.
that will record everything
yeah.
at all times.
Yeah.
Right? And what do you do with that?
Yeah.
Because I also am old enough to remember when the iPhone came out. I'm old enough to remember when social media happened. I'm old enough to remember when everyone was like, no one will ever accept this, right? No right. one's going to walk around their house and give the Chinese their coordinates of their apartment. That would never happen. It's like, they do, right? So, you know, there's a double-edged sword to that, right? One is to say, there's going to be these new devices that ask these new questions of us. And then there's this other side to say, well, you know, what kind of societal rituals do you need to make in order to weather that, right? The classic example is when you have your always-on device, is it going to be rude? Likely it will be very rude in very private scenarios to have it on, yeah. right? And so it's like, okay, well, we need to invent the handshake here. And of course, there's an amazing book, and I forget the woman who wrote it, which is terrible, but I reference it all the time, called Strangers and Intimates. She's a member of the Royal Society in the UK, really clever woman whose name I can't remember. But it was all about, again, talking about the contingent, kind of the invention of privacy.
Yeah.
That, you know, this was something that kind of emerged over a period of time. Speaking to someone, you know, 500 years ago about our concept of privacy today would be very abstract. Just as in a way, honestly, speaking to someone 25 years ago about the different social rituals we have around, you know, always on devices would be quite abstract. And so the question then is to say, okay, well, how would we live with such a world? And the second part, which I think is relevant to the hallucinations or this kind of blurring of reality, is you're then kind of talking about an enchanted world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? And it's funny, when you were talking, I was thinking back. So we did some work with OpenAI in like 2021. It was during COVID. Was that 20? Yeah, it was 2020. And we were in San Francisco at the time. And it was dead. There was nothing happening. We were in this like big block, no one was working, and we were working with DALL-E 1 at the time, which was like the best model,
yeah, yeah.
the best image model. And there was this certain point where we were driving to this like empty kind of office every day, where it became really, really viscerally obvious that the images around me were plastic,
yeah,
in a way that the typing stuff was. There was this blur happening. I'm like, this reminds me of Twitter, actually. Like, I remember when Twitter came out.
Yeah.
And there was this visceral moment where my brain shifted.
Yeah.
And I was like, all of a sudden, I'm talking to you, and I'm also talking to someone in Brazil.
Yeah.
And my brain and the way I formulated sentences and everything was changing, and it was involuntary. It was like, yeah. now that's there. I can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, yeah, there, I really enjoyed that part of the presentation, and I think that, yeah, invariably is going to change a great deal, and the question is, what do you do about it? You know, glass half empty, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, those are great responses. Do you want to ask a question? No. It was your question. Yeah, it was your question. Do you want to ask?
No. I don't know what question you're talking about. Go ahead.
Well, Trevor, you're like, okay, we have legal systems and we have warrants and judges and stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. But I mean, to your point of like an image is a common piece of evidence in court, right? It's
yeah.
a common piece of evidence. Yeah. And the other thing that happens is a story is told and then that image is rendered on the juror's brain.
Yeah.
And we live generally, you know, in each society kind of has a general baseline commonly held vision. So that when you tell a story about like somebody stealing a diamond necklace, it sort of is the same in everybody's head, right?
Yeah.
But now we're getting like dialects of vision,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And increasingly so, different like income tiers are going to be subscribing to better models, like somebody who's using Claude versus somebody who's, you know, using Gemini. So what then happens? How do we learn to trust each other? I mean, if we can't see the same thing, and I mean see in the way that you're talking about it, in our mind's eye,
yeah.
like what happens to trust? Where did the beginning ground?
Yeah. So in the book, I call this the fragile truce.
Yeah.
And like what I mean by the fragile truce is that we kind of made a deal about democracy and empiricism. Like this is the modern kind of deal. The modern deal is we're going to have faith in empiricism. And like that is a faith-based system, like you can do stuff with it, but like science is a form of monotheism, right? So you sort of build a theory of democracy on top of that, says like, okay, we're going to choose to believe that all people are equal, you know, again, at this very high level, we're going to choose to believe that empiricism is a privileged avenue towards truth. And we're going to combine those into a theory of democracy where, because we all are looking at the same evidence, and we're going to use reason to like figure out how to go forward. Now, of course, that's not how it worked out and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, don't give me shit. But like, that's like, that is like the high level satellite theory of liberal democracy, as far as I understand it. That seems cooked to me. Right. And like, there's plenty of evidence of that. And like the image world of the Trump administration is like clearly, you know, on one hand, you know, memeing himself as Superman while like removing sensors from the ocean so that climate change goes away because we can't see it anymore. Right. So the question is then, if we want to have stuff like democracy, like, what kind of deal do we have? You know, what kind of metaphysics do we like collectively decide to opt into, right? And the danger is that if you don't do that, like you end up with a kind of fascist nihilism. At least that's my fear. And, you know, I think that's a lot of our friends' fears. And, you know, this is why we talk about, you know, Bureau of Cognitive Safeties and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's a lot of social contracts being broken right now, and I guess the question is what the new one is. I agree with you. I mean, I'd agree with those priors about liberal democracy and so on and so forth. I mean, again, I fall on the more optimistic side of it, where I'm like, you know, I'm doing some work at the moment on, let's just say that your interaction with an LLM is private. Yeah. Let's just say it can be.
Yeah.
And let's just say that you can register your actual concerns about something, your actual concerns about something happening locally to you.
Yeah.
There is a way to kind of, you know, increase, let's say, the resolution mm-hmm. of democratic participation yeah. through these that was prior impossible.
Yeah. Right?
Now, there's all kind of things that could go wrong in the middle of that you have mm-hmm. to protect for, but I'm somewhat optimistic that that's going to happen, or I'm somewhat kind of resigned to that mm-hmm. To that happening. The other side too is.
But those are still political decisions, right? Like there is a conscious effort to craft a politics there, right?
For sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the second part, which I think again is in my kind of crusade against the attention economy as we understand it, is to say the problem with the attention economy is that we don't actually value attention enough, mm-hmm. right? So there is this kind of market push to monetize attention in a particular way, but we didn't take it seriously. Mm-hmm. In essence, I mean, the attention economy is a very old theory, right? It's from the 70s, yeah. I guess. In essence, the idea that we have scarce time mm-hmm. Is quite a useful economic primitive. The problem is that we spend it redundantly, right? The problem is we're in kind of environments that don't kind of apportion our attention in a way that is productive or don't save our attention, right? They're kind of incentivized to have you click on the same video over and over mm-hmm. again, like press the button, yeah. right? And so I'm particularly interested there looking at, for example, what, you know, I mean, one of the fun examples like to think about, I think some of the AGI stuff is really overblown, but as a thought experiment, it is quite interesting to think, okay, let's just say this does happen. Let's just say that, you know, these models are inevitability. I think that's somewhat true. And the world reorganizes itself in a particular way. Let's hope that Germans can use the same models that Americans can. Mm-hmm. In that universe, what are the scarce kind of valuable things now that we aren't valuing enough, mm-hmm. right? That will emerge over time to be incredibly valuable in an economic sense. Like, what are the jobs, mm-hmm. right? And I was sitting in a club with a German economist who just left the Munich Security Conference talking about Trump's, like, it was very like, what are we going to... and I was like, well, look at this club, right? It's like, I remember the 90s. I remember Blockbuster. If you were to teleport back to the 1990s and say, okay, everything's going to change, how would you explain to people the jobs of the present, right? You would say, you would look at influencers and you would say, okay, well, you know how like Brad Pitt sometimes gets flown to Japan to advertise a watch? That's everyone there, right? And people would be able to understand it, but they'd be like, what? Like,
yeah.
You know, like Stacy is, and it's like, yeah, she's doing that now, right? But it was this thing that was latent that just kind of emerged. Or to use the Blockbuster example, like all these films actually aren't worth that much, but the recommendation board over there is really worth a fuck ton, right? And you're like, yeah, I can kind of see that, but it is kind of worth it. That's helping. Yeah, it's helpful. So I think the fun experiment now, and one of the closest things I can get to is actually in a kind of Simone Weil kind of way, like looking at attention mm-hmm. to be like, maybe some of these ideas were quite good, mm-hmm. but we didn't take them seriously enough. Mm-hmm. And that actually being a faithful witness, mm-hmm. right? In the same way that if you look at the media and concerns about AI-generated media, you would say, well, this is really a forcing function to take very seriously the fact that that reporter needs to be on the ground in the Congo, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And the Substack economy still hasn't figured that out, right? Mm-hmm. So in actuality, we were undervaluing the role of journalism. We were undervaluing the role of these things because they will actually emerge to have mm-hmm. even more value. We've had this 25-year detour of nonsense that, and this is a forcing function for us to take it very seriously. You know, So that's. But I think all of that requires kind of, thinking like a machine, but also thinking in these kind of abstract terms about how information and society is organized. And then I would just hope that, there can be some kind of optimistic thrust to make sure it doesn't all go to crap.
I want to believe that. And I do believe that, right? I guess the place where I bristle a little bit is that, there is a political economy to this stuff. And, there are trillionaires, that are like, I'm just going to decide what the election is going to be and pay everybody, And so, that's been a feature of the tech industry, is the incredible consolidation of wealth, attention, information at the same time. And so that's the other part of it that gives me pause a little bit, where I agree with you. If we sat around at the United Nations with the world's smartest people and the Pope and so and so, and the next
thing. I want to hear about the Pope though. It's been my favorite reading the past 6 months has been the encyclical and the Quo Vadis Humanitas. Banger of a text. Read one text besides Trevor's book. Read this consortium. Can you talk a bit about? We just saw some funny memes also.
Well, I just love that the Pope has become kind of the I think about him as the opposite side of the Trump meme.
Right. Yeah.
Where it's you have the kind of fascist Trumpy stuff over here, and then you have the Pope, who is also the original kind of for breakout generative AI meme, and then he's become the
Balenciaga.
Exactly. We have the Balenciaga coat, right? And then he's become the kind of counterpoint to the J.D. Vance kind of theology or whatever it is.
Speak a bit about their position, both of you. I know, Matt, you've also...
The guy that does that policy stuff, right, for the Pope?
It's been really interesting. For me, it's been a very anchoring reference. I really appreciate that as part of the discussion. How do you feel that what is that? And, what is that to the larger tech discourse? And if you have any personal feelings about the weaknesses or strengths?
Well, to me, what's so interesting about it is that it's it's sort of him owning that reinsertion of theology into the conversation.
Totally.
Right? If you talk all these Silicon Valley, this is not a blanket statement, but it's close to a blanket statement. If you talk to two big industries in California is biotech and AI. You talk to the biotech guys, super rational, super scientific, super precise, blah, 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 blah. You talk to AI guys, it's like talking to people on acid sometimes, right? Where they're just because nobody knows how the fuck this stuff works, right? And so you get into all this occult kind of weirdness.
It's a materialist religion, right? AGI is a faith-based concept, right?
Yeah.
These guys are kind of religious zealots, and that's kind of scary. Anyways.
Yeah, but a piece of that is the Catholic thing, right? And to me, that weirdly makes a lot of sense because it is Catholicism in particular is a kind of enchanted theology, right? And so it's interesting to me how I don't think it's a coincidence that literally the Pope, the head of Catholicism, becomes a very relevant voice here, right? As the decider.
Yeah.
He's also just the only guy who's kind of clouded enough to speak on a level. He's kind of it'd be Michael Jackson being very cautious about AI very publicly or something. There's not that many people who can speak as loud as Elon Musk or something. So,
yeah, I think again on the social contract comment, it's people reaching for something in a time where there appears to be no one in charge.
Yeah,
and the unfortunate thing is there is actually no one in charge. That's the other kind of striking thing when you look at the Anthropic leadership or whatever. Yeah. I'll be quite candid about this in the sense that no one's in charge. And also you have this insufferable, kind of untenable latency between state governments and the developments happening in AI is just, that's leaving open this clearing for something to emerge. And I do have to say, I've been to a couple of things with people from the Vatican before and, I call the one in particular, I called the mid Illuminati, where it's Noah Harari and these kind of people like reading Reddit threads. It was like the worst. And then there was a guy, and then there was a guy from the Vatican, a guy called Paolo, who can cite Donna Haraway off the top, off the dome.
Right.
Who is the smartest person in the room. And I'm like, oh, wow. And I mean, I've learned this now since, because my brother studies, he's in like political economy. And he was like, oh yeah, the goat in my field is a woman who consulted the Pope for 60 years before she died a few years ago. And I was like, oh, interesting. So The point is that you have this structure that's concerned with belief and reality and dignity and all these kind of principles. And so, yeah, I'm actually very encouraged by it. I mean, I did think the encyclical, there were certain parts of it where I was like, ah, this is a bit, you know, a little bit kind of jejune.
No, sure, but it is a doubling down on the human within this enchanted world, or like a cult world, which,
and I think the scary part is, honestly, and this is when we were really grasping at straws, which I think is the most fascinating thing about your presentation, and probably you go deeper into it in the book, is what I said earlier about Levin. There is, you know, there are humanistic overtones that we have to maintain, of course, right? There, but then there's this other question of saying, well, as a result of encountering these very complex systems, what are we learning about ourselves, and what about that is uncomfortable, right?
Yeah.
And I think that that's really the level up, because in terms of like Catholicism and so on and so forth, I think it can be a source of great comfort. And thank God someone's out there advocating for human dignity in a time where state governments just seem completely incapable. Mm-hmm. However, right, there is a concern that one might fall back on the old stories.
Exactly.
They would fall back on a kind of kitsch humanism where we're lying.
Yeah.
And I think the most fascinating thing about this research that you're doing is ultimately that it's uncovering, the idea of activating neurons in the brain, the idea of, I mean, if anyone's here's familiar with, like, you know, the Halle Berry neuron, or the Jennifer Aniston neuron, the idea that maybe we learn from this that the advertising industry is a cancer.
Yeah, it's literally like a biological part of
it's
your
body. It's a
biological
body. Weapon, right? Mm-hmm. So, okay, now we learn that. There's a really uncomfortable truth about that, because I've done a lot of work on arts policy. What, 20% of the creative industries are predicated on this thing that perhaps needs to go away.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I'm really interested in these uncomfortable truths.
Yeah.
And I think sticking with them will come to really interesting conclusions. And of course, the conclusion is not to say, like, we're not worth anything. There's no difference between us and an apple. Right.
Right.
That's a conclusion some people might make. But ultimately, sticking with that difficulty is really good. And I'm just glad that the Catholic Church is stepping into it. Yeah.
On the other hand, it is interesting that a lot of this stuff now is turning into kind of a public health discourse, right? Like, for example, with the TikTok lawsuits, they were uncovering internal emails saying if you watched, you know, 20 TikTok videos in a row, you were effectively addicted, right? In the same way that you'd be addicted to cigarettes. And so it is interesting to see where those conversations are going and how they're trying to be had within existing legal and political frameworks.
It's a funny extension of conspiracy theorizing too, right? If you think, is it Network, the movie? Like, you can't handle the truth.
Right.
I mean, I feel that way. I don't know if anyone saw the news this week. Midjourney is now starting a medical wing.
Yeah.
Right? And it's uncomfortable for people. I think it's quite remarkable to be quite honest. I'm kind of inspired. But at the same time, one of the terrifying things about that is being like, well, wait. You're proposing a world where I go and get myself scanned and learn that there might be something on my liver.
Or your insurance company learns there's something on your liver.
Whatever it is. But the idea of that level of insight and monitoring of something kind of so profound is absolutely terrifying. And yet I can foresee a world in 20 years where that is normal. Right.
Even weirder than that, Matt. I've been working with all these different like neuroscience labs, and they, you know, in that field, there's like this mythological helmet. Like, are you going to go to work one day and you have to put on a helmet and like that's how you interface with your computer and it reads your thoughts? And like a year ago, everybody's like, that's never going to happen. And like now people are like, yeah, that's probably going to happen. And it's not because the sensors have gotten better. It's that it's gotten better to get coarse data and like reconstruct like the pattern from that bad data, right?
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, Bratton refers to like the Copernican traumas, right?
Copernican traumas.
Okay. I think it might be an old Foucauldian kind of thing, but it's basic idea that you encounter a technology that changes you fundamentally.
Right.
You can't ever look back.
Yeah.
And one of the terrifying things about AI, which I again would frame as a positive thing, is we are learning we're not that special.
Mm-hmm.
Which I would say is individually, we're not that special. And yet collectively, we apparently accomplish remarkable things, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at like IP and all the kind of like drama happening with IP, you're learning that, your image in embedding space is like 0.00001 degrees more distinct than that person over there's image, right? Like, you came up with the same idea, right? And yet somehow as a species, we managed to kind of level up and keep doing remarkable things, but this is a collective accomplishment or whatnot. And that is its own kind of, you know, Copernican trauma or like truth bomb, you know, that is useful.
Well, I think that's true. Like, if we're going to do away with the bourgeois subject, for lack of a better word, like, fine, let's do it. But then let's have, like, we need to think about what political frameworks we're going to have for these different kinds of subjectivities. And, like, I don't think Elon Musk should decide that.
Yeah. Someone who lives in a simulation and she probably doesn't mind.
Thank you for listening to New Models, and thank you to Trevor Paglen, Matt Dryhurst, everyone at Sybil, and everyone who came out for making the event a success. I was very quiet during this discussion, partly because it's kind of impossible to shoot and host a panel at the same time, and partly because with many discussions related to AI, fundamental assumptions often differ. I find this really disorienting. But I am very interested in hearing your responses to the propositions in this panel and discussing them with you on Discord. We're off to the USA this week and we'll be posting next from rural Maryland before heading to Montreal for MuTech. That's all for now. See you next episode.